From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM later tonight. Oh, yeah, those open lines. Here's what's happening. Well, if you have the app TikTok on your phone, you might want to take it off. President Donald Trump says that he will ban the popular short-form video app TikTok from operating in the United States, rejecting a potential deal for Microsoft to buy the app from its Chinese-owned parent company. Now, the move was aimed at resolving policymakers' concerns that the foreign-owned TikTok may be a national security risk. Goodbye, TikTok. The unemployment benefits that have kept millions afloat in the United States amid the worst economic crisis in a decade officially expired tonight. Weekly jobless claims continue to rise. Economic forecasters are warning of another slowdown, and the coronavirus has resurged across most of the country. And the U.S. Senate, where are they? They've adjourned for the weekend. So far, no unemployment benefits for the weeks ahead, unless things change. The federal government traditionally plays a major principal role in funding and overseeing the manufacturing and distribution of new vaccines, which often draw on scarce ingredients and need to be made, stored, and transported carefully. There won't be enough vaccines for all 330 million of us right away if you plan to get one. So the government also has a role in deciding who gets it first and in educating a vaccine-wary public about its potential life-saving merits. Right now, it's unclear who in Washington is in charge of oversight, much less any critical details about some health officials and members of Congress telling the Reuters news agency. Nobody really knows what's going to happen if and when a coronavirus vaccine comes out. A new forecast projects that 1 in 3 U.S. restaurants may close permanently this year, showing how the COVID-19 pandemic is decimating an industry that employs millions of Americans. As many as 231,000 of the nation's roughly 660,000 restaurants will likely shut down this year, and in most cases, permanently. 20% of Major League Baseball teams have been forced to postpone games tonight because of positive coronavirus tests, and the entire season, what's left of it, is in jeopardy. The sport has been back for just about a week, and games between the Washington Nationals, Miami Marlins, Philadelphia Phillies, Toronto Blue Jays, Milwaukee Brewers, St. Louis Cardinals, all postponed because of the coronavirus. Just what is going on with the virus? Well, let's check in with Christian Weil from myheartbook.com for his report this week. Christian, what do you find for us?
Well, in this time in our lives, with many of our friends and family members leaving us because of this insipid, indiscriminate virus, it seems the best science can do for us is to tell us to wear our masks, good advice, wash our hands, more good advice, keep our social distance, and hope for a cure. Can't we do better than that in year 2020? I just read a story online, George, of a wedding party where 100 attendees became positive with the virus.
Jeez.
And the groom himself died 2 days after his own wedding. This is so unreal. And with few options available, nothing that appears to be working should be overlooked.
This is not made by Mother Nature, Christian. That's, you know, there's something very strange going on here.
No, I think you've nailed that pretty well, George. It's just, it's too hard to believe that it just happened.
What's going on with the anti-malaria drug?
The anti-malaria drug, interesting, because hydroxychloroquine is an anti-fungal drug, as opposed to turmeric, which is an antiviral drug.
Right.
Okay, back to the mixed messages we keep mentioning, George, you and I, like the study from the FDA that says a drug fails, but the Ford Medical Center in Michigan says the drug in question, hydroxychloroquine, has saved 50% of their COVID-19 patients' lives. Now, there's a growing number of leading physicians and scientists who believe we are overlooking a valid therapy and they're becoming more and more vocal, believing that the inexpensive 60-year-old drug hydroxychloroquine has already saved a great number of COVID lives worldwide.
With zinc, right?
With zinc. That's the latest addition to it. A drug that was approved some 60 years ago has now been banned by the FDA, and is the very one that physicians have used with outstanding results in saving their COVID patients. And several of these doctors in the trenches have appeared and becoming more vocal, and just recently this week appeared with Vice President Pence at the White House, and to voice their indignation that the politicians are telling them how to practice medicine. And they what they're talking about, Todaro explained it this way. He said, "We're doing everything to restore the power of medicine back to doctors. Doctors everywhere," he said, "should be able to prescribe hydroxychloroquine without repercussions or obstruction." When Harvey Reich, a respected epidemiologist from Yale Medical Center, appeared on a national TV show just this last week, a doctor who's been up close and personal with the success in administering this drug believes and said nationally that he believes 75% to 100,000 lives could be saved using hydroxychloroquine.
And maybe more, Christian, maybe more. Christian's website, myheartbook.com, his toll-free number to call, and he will give you assistance, 1-866-STEM, S-T-E-M, 1-2-3. That's 1-866-STEM-1-2-3. Christian Wild, our great author, one of his books includes Miracle Stem Cell Heart Repair. A Christian exorcist who has been ridding people of their demons since 2013 has revealed one of the most disturbing cases where a woman transformed into a serpent-like being. The Reverend Bill Bean, author of several books and guest on Coast to Coast about demonic possession, says that he had an exorcism in which a woman under the thrall of possession was said to have snake-like eyes and contorted her body like a slithering reptile. He said it was one of the scariest exorcisms he's ever been part of. Amazon says it will invest $10 billion for its planned space-based internet delivery system after winning U.S. regulatory approval to deploy more than 3,000 low-orbit satellites. Can you believe that? Well, when you look up in the sky, you may think they're UFOs. That means you'll be calling Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, you don't want those kind of calls, do you?
No, I don't, George. You're right. But it's been a very busy week, and I'm delighted to be able to start off my report by reporting that our webmaster managed to get about 220 reports, new reports, posted to our website, among which are the following five. The first one comes from the 18th of July, Saturday, from Lakeview, Ohio, northwest of Columbus and north of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. A husband and wife were out photographing the comet Neowise when their attention was drawn to a very bright, distinctly bluish beam of light coming at them from the western sky. The husband had the presence of mind to grab a camera and start filming. George, this is some of the most interesting film I've seen in a long time.
That means a lot. That means a lot.
Yeah, I have no idea what he captured on film. We should have it posted to our website sometime this weekend, but it's about five times the size of the planet Jupiter in the southeastern sky, evening sky, and it is blindingly bright. He equates it to burning magnesium, which is very bright. He said he's never seen anything like it, and I'm inclined to believe him because he describes himself as an amateur astronomer for the past 35 years. Very competent, very capable witness. Second report comes from Joplin, Missouri. This is this past Sunday night, the 26th of July at 7 p.m. young woman who describes herself as a professional academician and probably a very good witness, I suspect, was driving south on Interstate 49, south of Joplin, Missouri. The attention of all of them was drawn to an object in the western sky to their right as they went south. It was a diamond-shaped object, almost a rhomboid, flashing, strobing very rapidly, passing in and out of clouds. Have no idea what it was, but it sounds like a very unusual sighting. Next sighting comes from Lancaster, California. A husband and wife, 3 hours after the sighting in Joplin, were camped out in rural California north of Lancaster. They saw an object in the western sky that looked like a pyramid, except it was hovering motionless in a clear and cloudless sky. Suddenly it disappeared, and it was replaced by a black orb that went streaking across the sky. The husband estimates that it was moving at 300 knots within 100 feet of the ground. That's unimaginably fast in a dark environment. And I'm inclined to accept his assessment of speed because he describes himself as a former U.S. Navy fighter pilot with 4,000 hours accumulated. I'm inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt on the speed. The fourth and last report I'd like to touch on comes from Seaside, Oregon, on the coast of Oregon. Gentleman describes that Wednesday morning of this week, about 30 minutes past midnight, he saw a very distinctly golden object streak across the sky, do a U-turn, and go back from where it came from, all within about 3 seconds. So there's a lot of activity, and if people see things, I hope they'll consider reporting to the National UFO Reporting Center.
Super. Peter Davenport, and he heads up the National UFO Reporting Center, indeed. He's one heck of an investigator. Up next, ghost hunting, apparitions, poltergeists. John Fraser joins us live from the United Kingdom on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest tonight, John Fraser. He's a noted author and investigator. A couple of his books include Ghost Hunting, A Survivor's Guide, and Poltergeist, A New Investigation into Destructive Haunting. John is currently a member of the Spontaneous Cases Committee and the Council of the Society for Psychical Research. He has previously been vice chairperson of the Ghost Club. That was founded, folks, back in 1862. And joined the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena in its founding year. Amongst his other related interests, he has helped publicize the Second World Dracula Congress in Romania, as well as assisting in promoting the specialized Dracula tourist market to the region out there. In 2015, he conducted an in-depth research into the well-known and controversial poltergeist-style phenomena at The Cage, which is a former jail. And that's out there in the United Kingdom, John, isn't it, that jail?
It is indeed. And first of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting me onto your show. It's actually the perfect date for me, August the 1st, because my book on poltergeist is out today.
Perfect. And
normally, I would be having a gathering of my colleagues at the Ghost Club on Saturday evening, but that unfortunately has been cancelled due to COVID. So in effect, this is my launch party. So thank you for inviting me.
Well, great. It's great to have you with us. John, how did you get interested in this phenomena of ghosts and poltergeists and apparitions? How did that happen?
To be honest, it probably dates back to my when I was a teenager, sort of 13, 15, I'd been indoctrinated into horror films. And then suddenly I saw a documentary in which I found people were actually taking things seriously. It was actually a documentary by then president of the Ghost Club, Peter Underwood. And that just totally fascinated me. And as soon as I was old enough, I joined the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena, a title not to be said after a couple of beers, and then subsequently joined the Ghost Club after doing a little project at a place called Sandwood Bay, and corresponding with Peter Underwood. So it was, I mean, there's not a lot of mysteries around anymore. We've been to the moon more than 50 years ago, and it just fascinated me to know there was one, at least one genuine mystery out there, paranormal phenomena.
Super. We're going to take calls with you next hour, John, from our audience, which loves ghost stories and poltergeists. Now, a poltergeist vampire, what is that exactly?
Well, you can have a poltergeist mongoose as well, actually, but let me explain a little bit more. Now, we have a term called poltergeist for types of unexplained phenomena which involve throwing things around, object movements, rapping on the walls, sometimes pools of water, very occasionally fires. We call that poltergeist, which is German for noisy ghost. That's the term that's become very, very accepted in North America and the UK. However, seems that only poltergeists exist in North America and the UK, except when you look a little closer. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been to, as probably made clear from your introduction, I've been to Transylvania about six times, and I've gathered a good bit about Romanian folklore. Now, obviously, in Eastern Europe, you have the concept of a vampire.
Right.
But when you look more closely and take away the Bram Stoker imagery of somebody in a black cape, etc., etc., the actual genuine reported vampire cases involve entities which supposedly come back from the dead, but make a lot of noise, throw things around, rap on the walls, and basically behave just like our poltergeists. If you go to Latin America, they have a thing called a duende, which is roughly translated a goblin. Now, in a lot of Latin American Spanish companies, they don't have a word for poltergeist. And funnily enough, these goblins are, when you actually look at the reported cases, are things that throw stones, make lots of banging noises, sometimes communicate, and behave just like a poltergeist. So throughout the world, you have the same type of phenomena described in very different ways. The poltergeist mongoose was actually a little case in the Isle of Man where a young teenage girl identified the being as being a mongoose because she'd read about it, I think, in a magazine and thought mongooses were quite a sort of novel thing. So she just identified it as being a mongoose. The real problem here, of course, is whilst we kind of take poltergeist seriously, a lot of investigators, even paranormal investigators, wouldn't want to go vampire hunting or goblin hunting, so they miss out on a lot of very interesting cases simply because they're culturally identified as something else.
Would they be scared to go vampire hunting, John?
Would I be scared to go vampire
hunting? No, or anybody who goes hunting.
I know some would. I certainly wouldn't, because A, it's just a poltergeist under another name, and if you're scared to go poltergeist hunting, you shouldn't be in the business, for want of a better expression. I suspect some people would be a little bit freaked out by the mythology behind it, but they can speak for themselves, I'll speak for myself.
John, why are these poltergeists seem to be so evil? I mean, how were they created in the first place?
To be honest, I don't, if anyone is having any poltergeist issues out there, I don't really consider them to be evil at all.
Really?
I would look down on somebody that comes to somebody's private home and calls himself a demonologist, for example, mm-hmm, because all it's going to do is scare the, exacerbate the situation and scare the family more. I mean, poltergeists, whatever they are, and that is an open debate, behave basically like a two-year-old child with ADHD.
Hold on, John. Hold on right there. We're at a break. We'll come back and talk more about poltergeists and your work. I'm George Norrie. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, we'll be back in a moment to continue our discussion about poltergeists with John Fraser. We'll take calls with him next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I hope you've been up to the coasttocoastam.com website to read all the stories, follow the guests. And, of course, our news editor of the Coast to Coast AM website is our very own Tim Banal, who writes it in a very Friday night column called In Coast, You Missed It. And, Tim, welcome back. And what do you have for us this week?
Hey, George, good to talk to you. As a matter of fact, it's kind of our anniversary. We started doing these news segments two years ago at the beginning of August. So thanks
we
for
sure
having
did.
Me on this past year, and here's to a great third year of news segments.
Many more.
Absolutely. Now, the first story we've got comes from New York's Hudson Valley region, and it's a very strange Bigfoot encounter. An unnamed woman who reported this to a Bigfoot research organization in the area says at the beginning of July, she was walking through a forested area in the community of Hyde Park when she spotted a huge creature that looked to be between 6 and 7 feet tall. So your textbook Bigfoot, essentially.
Exactly.
And this beast came running at her, charges at her, and she could hear these heavy footsteps. And all of a sudden, when it got close to her, this is very weird, it jumped up into a tree above her and started shaking the branches and leaves and stuff was falling down upon her. And then it was leaping from tree to tree, which is unlike anything I've ever heard of with a Bigfoot. But she seemed pretty confident that that's what she encountered. So it sounds like there's an aggressive Bigfoot roaming around in New York's Hudson Valley right now. So folks should be on the lookout for that. Now, the second story, I think you're really going to like this one a lot. We had this last week, and I wanted to save it for when I talk to you tonight. This is really a heartwarming story and one I think that folks will appreciate and kind of good for this time that we're going through right now. Dan and Karen Miller, their family in Minnesota, their son Aiden passed away on July 22nd of last year.
Oh, geez.
So the anniversary of his death was coming up. He was a teenager. He passed away at the age of 16 from a heart condition. And they were visiting his grave leading up to the anniversary of his death. And one day they noticed that there was a red hen hanging around the gravesite of their son. And they had no idea where this hen came from, but it just showed up one night. And then it stayed there. It's been there ever since. It's been hanging around at the grave of Aiden for a couple of weeks at that point leading up to his anniversary. And as his dad noted, it's pretty wild. There's probably a thousand other stones in the cemetery, he said, but it just refuses to leave this one. And what makes it even more remarkable is that the family has a farm, and one of Aiden's favorite things to do was to take care of the chickens on the farm. So they think maybe it was sort of a message from him of support, because right when it showed up, his mom had just gotten a diagnosis for breast cancer. So she thinks that the mysterious chicken had appeared at the gravesite and has been hanging around there as maybe a message from the other side to show some support. And as his mom said, she doesn't believe in coincidences. So I thought that was right up our alley on Coast to Coast.
Super. Tim, thanks for all your work. Really appreciate
thanks.
It. Tim Banal, our news editor of coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're back with John Fraser live in the United Kingdom. Poltergeist, a new investigation into destructive haunting, his book, which has just come out. John, can you give us a poltergeist story, one that has just fascinated you over the years?
There's many poltergeist stories that have fascinated me. Probably the one I'm best able to discuss about is one I've looked into in quite a lot of depth, which is a place called The Cage, which is prison in St. Osyth's, Essex. Now, this is a strange case indeed. It's actually the house is a lot more innocent than it sounds, in that it's a small semi-detached house, probably about 250 years old, possibly on the definitely incorporating a local lockup, which used to be where they'd keep the village drunks before, you know, they could send them to the magistrates, and possibly incorporating an older lockup. At least there is a plaque on the on the wall of unknown origins saying it dates back to the late 16th century, and possibly a witch, Ursula Kemp, was kept there before being tried and hung for witchcraft. Now, Ursula Kemp definitely exists. The rest are probably possibles. But a lady called Vanessa Mitchell moved into there, and along with some friends initially, and a lot of strange things started to happen. Doors used to slam shut without any reason. At one point, a pool of blood was found in the floor, and a Coke can flew across the room. Various of the residents got pushed. Various of the friends were witnesses as well. Once her friends moved out, she decided she could no longer stay there, left the house, and opened it up for paranormal investigation. And at one point gave me and a colleague of mine, Rosie O'Carroll from the Ghost Club, basically carte blanche to not primarily to investigate the place in the conventional sense, mm-hmm. A lot of people have done that, but to interview all the witnesses, both from the original events and the subsequent paranormal investigation teams that had been there. And what we found is a lot of people had seen and experienced a lot of similar things in the same place. There was a particular door that would bang, you know, not just creak, but bang with considerable strength. There was various people that had been pushed down the stairs. There was at least 5 cases of poltergeist scratchings or markings when, you know, a scratch would suddenly appear on your arms or legs. And it was actually this combination of witness testimony that I actually found a lot more interesting, because it's one thing, for example, the Amityville Horror.
Right.
You're totally down to the family and what they saw or what they didn't see. But in a case like The Cage, you've got literally dozens of witnesses all having similar experience.
And all pretty credible, I assume, right?
And all pretty credible. It included a TV producer who was there in his personal capacity, not to produce a TV program just because he was interested. He actually claimed, I think, to feel total depression whilst in the place. There's people that have broken down there, literally, and asked to be taken home from 60 miles away and had to be picked up in the middle of a sort of investigation. There's a Scandinavian paranormal investigator who went there and basically broke down in tears. Now, we have to obviously correlate. There is a certain psychological factor of staying in a, inverted commas, haunted house. But this seems to go over and above that, that there seemed to be some kind of atmosphere there that triggers some kind of very unusual experiences.
And would you say that poltergeist cases are where you do not see the poltergeist or the ghost, the apparition, or do you?
Not at all. There seems to be lots of little boxes of paranormal phenomena. You were talking to your UFO expert earlier on, mm-hmm. and so on, and this psychics, witchcraft, occultism, ghosts, poltergeists. I tend to think it's one big box. As an example, colleagues of mine in the Society for Psychical Research had a book out called Poltergeists. They're always called poltergeist if it's about poltergeist, unfortunately.
Right.
But Their book actually was encyclopedic. They took 500 cases from history and found that in at least 30% of the cases, there was also visual phenomena, you know, more like hauntings, and in primarily a separate 30%, there was also audio phenomena like ghostly voices. So you've got one heck of an overlap. I'd go as far as to say, whatever it is, ghosts and hauntings are probably one and the same thing, different symptoms of the same phenomenon, of the same power.
John, what triggers a poltergeist case? What starts it?
Now that is the $68,000 question. Nobody can be sure. If anyone says it's demons or it's a dead person, with any degree of great certainty, they have their own hypothesis. I tend to think it's probably something within us. Nearly all poltergeist cases have a stress factor that seems to trigger it off. Now, it could be a death in the family, which obviously feeds into the afterlife theory quite well. It could be adolescence, which, if you remember, was quite a stressful time. It's a few years since I've had that, but yes, I remember that well. It could even be a house move, which is, I think, down as its top five stress factors in most surveys. So you get the wonderful thing of somebody moving into a house and suddenly finding it's haunted, but it could even be the fact that they moved into there in the first place and had their life disrupted that started it out. Let's go back to Amityville again. You had the guy that was overextended in his mortgage and moved into the house of a mass killer.
Yeah.
If that's not going to cause stress, I don't know what is. So I think that's the trigger thing. I tend to think, and only think, that that it's quite possibly powers within us that actually cause the phenomena to happen. Best example of that being the Philip experiment, which was an experiment done in Canada in the late 1970s, when a group of paranormal investigators decided to create a ghost stroke poltergeist. They invented this fictitious character, never existed, called Philip the Cavalier. They gave him a wife, a mistress, and all kinds of things, and invented a history by which his wife committed suicide and drew pictures of him and started to live his life, in effect. And then you started to get poltergeist events happening caused by Philip, who, of course, never existed, so couldn't be from the afterlife. And there's actually good footage in Canadian TV of these events happening. So I tend to go for the powers within us. However, just like your report on COVID, I dislike the fact that the paranormal community sometimes gets into political sort of trances. We should be working together. I could be wrong. The afterlife people could be right. In the same way as hydroxychloroquine might work, might not, but everyone seems to be in entranced views. Scientists do it. Paranormal investigators do it. I wish we wouldn't.
Is the paranormal field tense between rivals, John?
To some extent, it's not as bad. It's probably not as bad as it has been in the past. But yes, I mean, all fields are intense with rivals. Science is very intense with rivals. And yes, there is a certain amount of for your listeners that have seen Monty Python and Monty Python, The Life of Brian, there is a certain amount of the Judeans, People's Front, and the People's Front of Judea, you know, people, different groups that should be working for the same things, but are actually criticizing each other and so on.
Hollywood, of course, has done an amazing job depicting vampires. How close is that to reality?
Well, when Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, he'd never been to Transylvania. His He chose a totally fictitious depiction of vampires, and he even chose a place called the Borgo Pass, which he has as mountainous, which is actually very, very pretty and hilly. I've been there. So it was it started on a walk of fiction, and it's extended from a walk of fiction. The Romanian Strigoi, which is a Romanian vampire, is far less romantic looking when depicted. It looks a bit like a sort of wild animal. So it's not based on any real life vampire folklore at all.
It's amazing work, John. And your book is available on Amazon. Can people in the United States pick it up too?
People in Pacific time zone still have to wait 45 minutes. But yes, absolutely, it's on Amazon and all good book outlets in the United States. My publishers are based in Winchester, UK, and Washington, USA. So it's a multi.
Super.
It's a worldwide publication.
They take poltergeists pretty darn seriously in the United Kingdom, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're steeped in ghost and poltergeist folklore. Some of our hauntings are quite interesting, actually, because we kind of assume an old house or an old castle is haunted, and you get ridiculous ghost stories that couldn't possibly exist. Like, for example, there's a place called Ixham Moot, which is an old manor house in Kent, supposed to be haunted by Dame Dorothy Selby, who was supposed to be bricked up there during the gunpowder plot for betraying the Catholic cause. But in fact, she's actually buried down the road in St. Peter's Church, Ixham, and died 40 years after the gunpowder plot.
After it happened.
We've also got wonderful, wonderful romantic ghost stories that don't possibly exist. And once you take them away, the real modern ones are happening.
John, hold on. We're at the top of the hour break now, but we'll come back and talk more about your work, Poltergeist, A New Investigation and a Destructive Haunting. And, of course, we're going to take phone calls with our great listeners next on Coast to Coast AM.